We've already talked about the baptism of Jesus, and we did a little bit of parsing of that story, and I think you did some really good work on that. And we understood that that story wants us not to look at it as a newspaper report, a journalistic item. It wants us to look through it to see what it's saying about the human condition. And what are the consequences of accepting new states of consciousness, new forms of personal power? What can happen? And to give a caution. But I want to bring up these stories and talk with you about them, not because I've done a complete study of them, by no means have I, but they interest me as places to begin and peel off the layers that have been plastered on this most marvelous spiritual tradition that we have inherited. See, my purpose is not to stand against anything biblical or sacred writings. On the contrary, what I want to do is reveal much more of their power and their ability to inform at very deep levels. And I think some degree of crust has come across that. So you might have a story, and there may be time, I hope there's a little time for anyone to bring up a passage that has bothered you or you don't know what to make of it in the past and see if the group can help with that. I want to say a word or two about the story of David and Bathsheba. I want to talk a little bit about what happened after the desert experience at Jesus' baptism. What happened immediately after was the first act in his ministry of miraculous events. Water and wine. We'll have a word about that. And then I want to talk about the woman who bled when she shouldn't have. Too much. Do you know the story? The bleeding woman. Three things. We might have more that come up to mind as we do this. I want to do this in a very informal way. I want to present you with my story, which needs to be yours. I just want to have a conversation about this. And I invite you during this time, if anybody has a strong reaction or a point to add, to do so. Just raise your hand. And if that tends to slow us down too much, well, then I'll say, let's wait until the end. So let's start with David and Bathsheba. Very interesting story to me. You will find it in the book of Samuel, 2 Samuel. It starts about chapter 11 and then goes for a couple, three chapters. It's a fascinating story from the ancient world. Is it historical? It may have historical elements. There was a king, an ancient Hebrew king, who came after Saul, the first king. And we know that there was such a person. So there is a historical backdrop to what the action is here. As to whether it is historical in full respect, I'm inclined to say no, it's not. Except it is historical in an inner sense. It talks about the history of development of the human spirit, soul, psyche, if you will, to me. It's a story which, although it probably occurs in the BCE period, maybe in the 7th century, a little more, is still current today. Current today. You'd probably find it in the Sunday Times somewhere. It goes like this. David was king, and he had sent his armies out to some military action against the Ammonites. And they were out in the field, besieging a city as it happened. And David had walked out onto the parapets of his, I don't know if I should call it castle, wherever he lived, had an elevation. And he looked down around him into the city, and he saw an enclosed garden open to the sky, and in the garden sat a beautiful woman. And she was largely without clothing. I imagine she might have been attended by one or two servant persons. But she was bathing herself in what she thought was the privacy of her personal garden space. But the king has an elevated eye. And he looks down there and he says, yeah, that looks good. I think I want that. And so what does the king do? He tells one of his servants to go to the home of that person and invite the lady to the castle. Those things happen. And she comes. She probably had no choice. She came. Excuse me. And while they were there, of course, as David intended, they had sex. And afterwards, David said, in effect, I imagine, well, you can go home now. A little while later, Bathsheba, that was her name, informed the king that she was pregnant. And David says, I imagine, this rather complicates things. He knew her husband, whose name was Uriah. He was not a Hebrew, he was a Hittite. He was an officer in David's army. I make him out to be something like a captain or possibly a major because he had some charge of men. And David calls his counselor and he says, I want you to get a message to the general commanding, General Joab, at the front. And I want you to tell him that I want to speak with my servant and his officer, Uriah, and he's to send him to the castle immediately. And the message was passed. Uriah came to David's presence. Now here you see something of how David's mind is working. He said, what is the report of the action? And when you go back, I want you to speak to my commander in this way. Take this message with you. And by the way, go on home and spend the night. You can go on home and see your wife. And then David retires. He finds the next morning that Uriah did not go home. And he said, what are you doing staying up here by the castle? Uriah had made a pallet out by the castle gate and had slept outside all night, waiting until David could see him the next day. And, of course, David's plan was to get him to go home. If you can get him to go home, he will certainly have sex with his wife, and then the paternity of the child will be not pointing any fingers toward the castle. Now, the text doesn't say that, but you or I will read that, I'm sure. David is angry at this. How come you didn't do as I suggested and go visit your family? Why, there's nothing very, very familial about that. And Uriah said, Your Majesty, my general has a camp in the open space, and my men are sleeping on the ground in the desert. How can I go home? So David says, well, this calls for another plan. And he sent Uriah back with this message to General Joab. I want you to reassign this officer. First of all, I want you to make an assault upon the city, a direct assault upon the city. I want you to reassign this officer to a very front position. I want him in a place where he's likely to be killed. Well, that all happened. Uriah went back and was placed in an assault which took troops up very near the gate of the city where they were vulnerable to arrows from the city. And Uriah was killed. Well, of course, the word was brought back to his wife, Bathsheba, and she went into mourning, naturally, pregnant with David's child. When the period of mourning was over, David brought her to the castle, and he married her. You can see the status of a woman in those days was somewhat fluid, to say the least. But now David says, well, we'll at least have the child born to marriage. And in due course, the child was born. Now, the child was born with an illness that nobody understood. It did not thrive. David was concerned about this, but I dare say not a lot. Nevertheless, he paid attention to the sickly child, and within the span of a week, the child died. Well, that was a grievous fact. The child died. And there was a period of mourning for the child, and David, I think, was genuinely beginning to feel something wrong in this picture. Why does this happen to me just now? I'm the king, and I did, after all, marry the woman. Why is this allowed to happen? And he was troubled by these thoughts, and he sent for his counselor, a man named Nathan, who was a prophetic of prophetic kind. These are the people that kings would call upon to interpret non-rational seeming events. And Nathan came in, learned of the whole story, and he told David his own story. And this is the story that Nathan told to David. There was a man in a village, and he owned many flocks, many animals. He was a very wealthy man. And he saw that there was a poor family that had one goat. They used the goat for milk, and it would eventually, I suppose, be food. But that's all they had. It turned out to be enough, I guess, to keep the family in essentials, but only one. And this rich man looked at that, and he thought, that's a fine goat. I would like to have that goat. And being rich, he was able to go get it. And he caused the goat to be taken away from the man, the owner, and his family, and took it into his own flocks. The family was left with nothing. And as he heard this story, David was getting more and more agitated. And he thought, can you imagine that kind of behavior? This is impossible. Why, a person like that ought to be punished for that kind of behavior. And Nathan looks at him and says, Your Majesty. You know what he said? You are the man. You are the man. You are the man. And David said, What? Who? Me? And Nathan said, Yes, precisely. What you have done offends God. You have committed a sin. It's an evil thing that you have done because you murdered a man in order to take his wife. David was genuinely convinced of his guilt, and he went into mourning himself, and he prostrated himself, and he asked for forgiveness. It seemed that that was a shocking event which reverberated in him enough that it reached a place in him that had eyes to see what he had done. But you see the delusional aspects of power. A powerful ego can take steps without fear of being opposed often. Power can do that. This means there is no corrective in place for a really bad decision. So in due course, Bathsheba became pregnant again. And the castle was happy. And it seemed that life was moving back into familiar channels and grooves of right order. And so it was. The baby was born, and it was again a boy. I neglected to say the first child was a boy. The second child is also a boy, born to King David and his lawful wife, Bathsheba. And that baby was healthy and grew and prospered and became a famous figure in Hebrew history. Who knows the identity of the baby? Hey, you're experts. That was Solomon. Later to become King Solomon. Now, I would ask you, Solomon the Wise, David the fool at the start, the powerful fool, a bad combination. But David beget Solomon the Wise. Now, that's an entertaining story on its face. I mean, it makes good drama of the TV kind. What do you make of it? Do you see any light through that story? Can you see beyond it at all? What do you think?
I have some memory of somewhere in there, David begging God to save a child. Where does that come from?
David was concerned about the first birth. He went and he lay on the ground for days and nights, asking for some help. But that help didn't come. we may say that in the meaning and value of the story, we can't reverse what happened at first. That is, for David's original actions, there's a consequence. This story says, for willful, ego-based actions, there's always a consequence of some kind. And you can't undo this. This is, in a certain sense, not a scientific fact, I think, but it's a mythopoetic truth, I would say. It's a bit more in the realm of mythos than logos.
Well, my memory was that he begged God to say, you know, for this trial, and then finally he just said, okay.
Well, when they told him that the child had died, he got up, and he went back and got a change of clothes and a shower, I suppose, and then he went and had a meal. And people were a little bit astonished. And he said, well, it's done now. It's over. That's true. I left that little bit out. Does that story strike any deeper note for anyone? How about you?
I think the thing that I found remarkable about the story when I first... There are a couple of things that I found remarkable about the story when I first read it. One, the person who was murdered wasn't a Jew, who's a Hittite. So he wasn't a member of David's tribe, and yet God was getting upset about the fact that David killed him, when generally it seems like there's a pattern of you can kill any of these people who are in your way. Seems to be a theme in the Old Testament. The other was, my memory of the story is not that David calls for Nathan, but that Nathan comes to David.
And sorry, I didn't hear that.
My memory of the story is that David doesn't call for Nathan, but Nathan comes to David and tells David something he doesn't necessarily want to hear. And the fact that David, as king, didn't just kill him, like I guess prophets are often killed, if they tell things that people don't want to hear, is something that speaks for David in a way. I think that's why he's still considered a good king, or is remembered as somebody after God's own heart. That was something that I found kind of remarkable.
That's good. I don't remember the exact text. I think Nathan would have not walked in upon the king without some degree of invitation. But I think the text gives a great deal of autonomy to Nathan and presence. And the notion that the boy would be Hittite was never, of course, an encumbrance to Solomon. Of course, he wasn't. Solomon was fully Jewish. But his father was a Jew, and his mother also. At any rate, I think the points are interesting and a garnish on the story.
But Uriah, as in God objected to the killing of Uriah.
Yes. Yeah. Oh. Well, sure. Yes. Yes, he did. And he objected through his own spokesperson. Yes. Let's see. Right down here, Beth.
I have nothing wise to say. I just have to say that from the very beginning, when I heard this story as a child, I had the same trouble with so many Bible stories of listening to it as a woman. And if you think about it, of the choices of Bathsheba,